You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
The US has been attempting to promote democracy around the world for the past 25 years. Nice try. But has the policy been anything other than an abject failure? And we'll discuss whether Mitsubishi Motors can weather the data rigging storm that threatens to engulf its entire operation. Also on the program...
You have no idea what it means to have nothing. You don't value what we have achieved.
Forget House of Cards, we'll discuss how China's Communist Party plans to air a 42-part miniseries about President Xi's bid to tackle corruption. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to the show. My guests today are Matthew Green, who is a journalist and author and used to be the FT's man in West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Kathleen Burke is here too. She's a professor of modern and contemporary history at University College London and specialises in US interventions around the world. So what better place to start than this?
What we have seen is a redoubling of Saddam Hussein's efforts to destroy completely Kuwait and its people. I have therefore directed to use all forces available, including ground forces, to eject the Iraqi army from Kuwait.
Our firmness finally has brought an end to a vicious campaign of ethnic cleansing, and we acted early enough to reverse it, to enable the Kosovars to go home. When they do, they will be safe. They will be able to reopen their schools, speak their language, practice their religion, choose their leaders, and shape their destiny.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
We're under no illusions. Libya will travel a long and winding road to full democracy. There will be difficult days ahead, but the United States, together with the international community, is committed to the Libyan people.
Four US presidents there. Foreign Policy magazine poses the question today, why is America so bad at promoting democracy in other countries? It argues that policy is a constant theme that binds recent US administrations together, but that they haven't been very good at doing it. Is that a fair assessment? Kathy?
Well, it's a much more complicated situation than that, I think. First of all, you have to look at history. If we're looking mostly at the past 25 years, the Americans had the example before them of Japan and Germany, which they were able, so it says, to actually turn both of them into liberal democracies, which have kept that. So the question of history was good. Secondly, of course, is that the ones we were talking about mostly happened after the end of the Cold War. And so it looked as though America had been tremendously successful in the most important movement, in the half century. And thirdly, of course, Americans have always felt that they are so fortunate that most other people want to have what they have. And therefore, the best thing they can do, make the world safer democracy, as Woodrow Wilson said, is to try to help them gain the same sort of wonderful life that Americans have. But yes, they don't always work. And what Americans also seem to think, that give a constitution, have some elections, and there's no sense that things have to grow organically out of the soil. And of course, growing organically out of the soil doesn't allow you to go home and proclaim success.
Matthew, the piece argues a really interesting dividing line, saying that actually when you look at cases like, say, Myanmar, where there has been a successful transition, you need to kind of intervene whether through policy or through militarily, certainly not militarily in the case of Myanmar, but you need to intervene where there is already the kind of ambition for democracy on the ground. And then you have some chances of success if you're the US. But if you just go in with guns and there's no kind of fledgling democracy in place, then you're heading for disaster. Do you think that's a fair assessment of what's happened in recent years?
Well, I think it's a very interesting point. I mean, I look at this very much from the perspective of Afghanistan, where I spent a number of years reporting, and I looked in depth at the state-building project that was taking place. I remember spending 10 days in the Arghandab Valley, which is north of Kandahar in the south of Afghanistan, accompanying two young men in their 30s who'd been sent by US State Department to try to build democracy in this valley, which had been contested for years, not just by the Taliban, but by the Mujahideen and the Soviets before them. And it was fascinating to see them interacting with this community, which, of course, did have its form of self-regulation. It wasn't democracy in the formal sense, but they had their shura councils, their patronage networks. And what we were witnessing was essentially a sort of social engineering experiment. They had their local governor who they were sponsoring, who every day would drive up from Kandahar City in his battered old car with his two teenage sons in the back. And, you know, for a time, they seemed to be doing quite well. It was only a few months later that I heard the news that that governor had been blown up by a remote control bomb left on the roadside for him, and he was killed along with his two sons. So it shows how fragile all that work can be.
But Matthew, let's move beyond this piece and just ask you, in Afghanistan, for example, should there be kind of a more brutal and split divide? First of all, it wasn't really wrong for America to intervene in Afghanistan because we know what happened during 9/11. It was seen as a place where, that was sheltering Obama, sheltering Al-Qaeda. So there was a military imperative. It was fair enough, almost for revenge, in a sense.
Well, I'd argue the contrary, actually. I think that America walked into a very well-sprung trap as a result of the attack on the Twin Towers organized by Al-Qaeda. I mean, look at the cost of the money that has been spent in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the sum is something like $1.5 trillion. Look at the enormous numbers of lives that have been lost in both countries, many more civilian lives than military lives of US soldiers. I mean, it's been an unmitigated catastrophe. You can argue that from a political point of view, some sort of retaliation was going to be an imperative. But I'd argue that the consequences of that retaliatory impulse have been catastrophic.
But just looking at the other side of the argument, this split then, on the side of promoting democracy, I'm sure it may not have worked there. But wasn't that a reasonable ambition, at least? You can't go in and say, we just want to leave things as they are. Even if it doesn't work out in the way that you want it in a kind of Western model, wasn't it right to say, actually, there are women here, there are young guys, all sorts of people being treated in horrific ways by Al-Qaeda, by the Taliban, that we need to do something to kind of begin to transform this society, to give some people some hope?
Well, I wonder. I mean, I wonder. I think it very much depends on which part of Afghanistan you're living in, whether or not the US intervention has been a good thing. I mean, certainly the country's radically transformed from what it was in 2001 when the Taliban was still in power. Cities are thriving. There's urban life in a way that never happened before. I mean, the country is completely different. Large numbers of young women in education and so on. But let's not forget, the war's still on. I mean, there's thousands of Afghan troops being killed every year, many more thousands of civilians. And you know, this conflict that was unleashed in 2001 can grind on and on and on long after we've all forgotten about it.
So, Catherine, it's been a bit of a disaster, according to Matthew, in Afghanistan and potentially in Iraq and potentially in Libya too. Does that mean there is no case for intervention? Because again, when you come down on it, surely democracy is better than being run by the Taliban. And even if it has failed, surely there should be some way of intervening in these situations where you do some good and where you do give people on the ground who have some ambition to change their society. Is it fair to do the opposite and just sit back and say, okay, we know you're being slaughtered, we know there is hideous things going on, but it's nothing to do with us?
Well, that was the argument that was going on in the 1990s, was it not, especially over Bosnia and Kosovo? I mean, there are interventions and interventions. I don't think the West didn't go into Bosnia to impose democracy. It went to stop one part of the community from slaughtering the other part of the community. So interventions can go in for purely humanitarian reasons, and I think that's probably pretty high up there. But, you know, when I agree, I see where Matthew is coming from, but it is difficult, is it not? If you go in, you're damned. If you come out, you're damned. If horrible things are happening, as Andrew implied, and people are killing each other, and especially people from outside are killing each other, and you're appealed to, it's very difficult. And then once you're in there, why are you in there? How do you support it? How do you keep your political support at home? You can't say to the Americans, well, we're going into Libya, and we'll do a bit, and then we'll just let them get on with killing each other. You have to try to do something. And if you're going to try to do something, are you just going to stand up one particular tyrant against another particular tyrant? Are you going to clear the ground by getting rid of everyone so you can start again? I think it is extremely complicated. I don't think there's one size fits all. And I think that getting involved, in many respects, numbers of times, is better than not getting involved at all.
Matthew, it's certainly a good example in West Africa with the British intervention in Sierra Leone in the late 1990s, which did
Absolutely.
Actually work extremely effectively and has patched the country back together, and to all intents and purposes has been a great success. So I'm not against intervention, you know, per se.
But if I put you in the White House, you're in charge, and you looked at some of the recent situations over the last couple of decades. Kuwait, for example, we heard that clip there. Now, actually, Kuwait was a reasonable success. Many people died, of course, but Kuwait was taken back from the Iraqis, and there was no ambition to go all the way to Baghdad. Some people felt in the end that was a mistake at the time. But in a way, that's an example of military might on the ground. It cleared people out, the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and it left a country at least a little bit kind of safer than some people living under Saddam Hussein.
Well, I suppose it's a complicated question, isn't it, to assess the legacy of that particular conflict. I think it's interesting to almost look at it less from the international affairs perspective, but almost from the psychological perspective. You know, I wonder how much America as a country is projecting in these cases. Let's look at what's happening in the States itself. We see a democracy, certainly in name, but which has been eroded very dramatically in recent years with the rise of corporate interests and so forth. We have a huge population of incarcerated prisoners, which is proportionately, I think, the highest in the world. Plenty of other growing inequality, plenty of other reasons to kind of worry about the state in which America is heading. Yet there's this kind of compulsion to export this model elsewhere. I just think it's kind of interesting to think about it from that perspective, as opposed to a sort of purely realist foreign policy framework.
And Kathy, just on that, do we go in, do we not? When we look at Syria, here's a big example of America not going in, and there's certainly no democracy being promoted. There's certainly tens and tens of thousands of people have been killed. And there is an argument that actually a little bit more of intervention there would maybe not have planted the seeds of democracy, but could have saved lives earlier on.
Well, but going in without an exit strategy, you're there and Russia decides they're going to come in as well. How do you know who to fight with or against? You have very few people who have great knowledge about Syria in the State Department or in the U.S. government at all. You don't know what you're doing. You're driven by military. That's the real problem, I think. United States, but also some other countries we can think of. You don't know what's happened. You don't know what you're going to do after you're there. And that gives intervention a bad name, I think.
Well, thank you. We're going to leave it there for a moment for this. Now, if the US has been failing to promote democracy abroad for the past 25 years, then Mitsubishi has been cheating fuel tests in Japan for just as long. The admission from the Japanese car giant came at a press conference in Tokyo a few hours ago. Matthew Green, who was the FT's man in West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Catherine Burke, who is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College, are both still with me here on Midori House. Matthew, as an example of a terrible example of bad practice in a giant corporation over many years, this kind of really takes the biscuit, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose you can make a hall of fame, couldn't you? I mean, you have tobacco companies manipulating nicotine to create addiction among their customers. You have oil companies denying climate change. You have Volkswagen also guilty of manipulating its the software which regulates testing for its emissions in the States. I mean, the list is almost endless, isn't it? I mean, we're back to this framework in which we see corporations almost as psychopaths, you know, purely motivated by profit and without any sort of self-restraining or kind of social responsibility.
And do you think that, you know, when you look at the car industry, that this is the same moment for them as happened for the banking industry when we had the mighty crash and we saw how much kind of like dodgy dealing was going on? Is the car industry in real trouble here in general?
Well, hopefully there'll be a more thorough accounting than there was in the financial crash when very few people went to jail. I mean, it seems to me that there's certainly some Volkswagen executives who might be in the frame in Germany where they're being investigated. And, you know, if people in these companies are lying to regulators and to the public about the damage that their products are causing, they should be punished.
Kathleen, you want to come in here?
Well, just that in the early 2000s, remember, Mitsubishi had to admit that since 1977, it had secretly fixed any defects without reporting it to the authorities. And what happened then, of course, was several people went to jail.
Good.
But Kathleen, when you look at what's happening with the car industry, there does seem to be a kind of a huge shift. We already know that many young people, it's the lowest number of people in the US, for example, registering for driving licenses since the 50s. People don't seem to be that keen on owning cars. People are unsure about what the car means to us. When you see examples like this, do you feel that there is a kind of a dislocation between the public and what they think about their car and what it represents? Cars are now seen to be a little bit kind of grubby, not good for society, and also now part of this kind of rather murky world of kind of, you know, dodgy testing as well.
So what are you asking?
I just wonder whether there is now a fault line through the car industry that is difficult for people to kind of come back from. We had our conference recently in Vienna and we had a representative from BMW i who, you know, quite passionately was saying for him in a positive way, he said this is the end of the car industry, not because of this scandal, but he said there is a change in how we see our cars, that the auto industry as we know it, the traditional auto industry, is going to die, and you have to get used to the fact that people will change their ownership of cars and things. And I just wonder whether this kind of pushes it on a bit, because people are concerned about the environment. Now they find that they have cars on their drives that they're not sure, you know, are they driving a car that's good for the environment or better for the environment? They just don't know anymore.
Well, I think that's a slight bit over the top. If you live in the United States, which from San Francisco to New York is London to Damascus, it is a large place. And cars aren't useful in the cities. I mean, and a lot of people in the cities in the States are giving them up for the same reason that here in London we don't have cars, because they're just too much like no place to park them, you know, and so forth and so on. But surely over the past couple of decades, cars in many respects, if they aren't lying about it, are becoming much better in terms of fuel. For example, much less setting out things one doesn't want to breathe or eat. So I think these things go up and down. Remember 10 years ago when we were all going to have fuel-free and it was electric and so forth?
Well, we've got to go there, haven't we? I mean, we're in a kind of planetary crisis at the moment with the climate. If we carry on all sitting on our own little internal combustion engines to get us from A to B, then, you know, we're not going to have much of a civilization left, are we?
Go out and say in Kansas.
I'd love to, actually.
No, people have to get places, don't they?
Yeah, they do. So let's hope this scandal, which is kind of opened up the kind of seamy side of the auto industry, is a boost for Tesla and Elon Musk's brainchild of having, you know, millions of electric cars driving around. That's what we've got to look forward to, isn't it? I mean, if we go on like this, we're going to be underwater.
I think we're going to park that one there for the moment. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Matthew Green and Kathleen Burke. Coming up in a few minutes.
You have no idea what it means to have nothing. You don't value what we have achieved. I have had to fight for everything my entire life.
Well, forget House of Cards. The Chinese Communist Party is launching its own miniseries about tackling corruption. We'll be right back after this.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product, and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design program Section D delves deep into the places, communities, and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Matthew Green and Kathleen Burke. We're going to be looking at Chinese TV shortly. But first, Kathleen, you wanted to talk to us about what we need to know in the US primaries as well. And I wanted to ask you, first off, if Clinton wins today, is that really a done deal? She has got the nomination. She is home and dry?
If she won all the delegates available in these five primaries, yes, she would, because she would have 23 over, in fact, what she needs. This isn't going to happen, of course. But if she wins pretty substantially in all five, there's not much left to do. In fact, Mr. Saunders appears to be moving more to think about influencing what the Democratic platform is going to be. In fact, moving to try to, you know, the political revolution as opposed to he himself being president.
And the extraordinary thing is, I guess, that Mr. Saunders has so much money in the bank, Kathleen, that he's going to be around all the way through to the convention. He's not going to disappear and give up even when she gets the right number of delegates, is he?
No, he's on the ballot. Why should he? So, no, and he has... She has the main thing she wants to do quite properly is she wants to be elected president. He's got two things he wants to do. He wanted to be elected president. This is unlikely to be the case, but he has been trying to stimulate what he calls a political revolution. And not being president, but still being in all these ballots means he has he'll have the exposure to media and exposure to people that will help him to push this.
Matthew, when we look at Mr. Trump's bid, is that going to be any further progress today? Because it seems that whatever happens, it looks like it is going to be a contested...
I've lost track of this. Is that the case? I mean, can we hope that the Trump machine is going to be derailed?
It looks like... Catherine, don't you think whatever happens, it looks like somebody is going to try and come up with a plot to kind of stop him at
someone
the convention?
Someone has to, right?
I mean... well, I'm not saying someone has to, but it just looks like it's going to, don't you think?
This would be plot mark two, of course, because plot mark one is which was that Cruz and Kasich were not going to run against each other in certain states, selecting the states that they had better chances in. And already within about 14 hours, they were saying, well, our voters should still vote for us. And no tactical voting, but they're not going to waste their money on adverts and having rallies in those states. The thing is that Cruz is on a roll, he thinks, because he's quite good at getting the delegates that people don't actually vote for. I mean, look at Pennsylvania, for example. It's got 71 delegates, 54 unbound. Only 17 actually have to back the candidate. So therefore, it's all to play for Cruz. Okay, you know, if Trump gets them.
And Kathleen, do you think that there we also see, you know, a more kind of tested politician knows about all the boring work that you have to do on the ground to win these votes. Because in a way, Cruz has kind of done all that, whereas Mr. Trump has relied on coming into town, making a big hurrah and shouting a little bit and kind of getting the votes. And now it's getting to the point where you do need to do some kind of gritty, almost door-to-door work.
Trump is great on wholesale politics. He's not very good on retail. And that's what Cruz is doing. And Cruz has got he's got a group of people going around doing these sorts of things that have done it before, know how to do it. Trump does not have this sort of gritty, as you would say, backup people who actually do these sorts of things.
Matthew, do you think he'd win? Who do you think would win if it's Trump versus Hillary?
Who I think?
Yeah.
Who I hope?
I think
Clinton would win because too many people detest Trump.
Mm. And just tell me, Matthew, when you look at this, battle from the outside in a kind of bigger context, the thing that Trump is correct about is that there is, in most countries, there's too much kind of politics done between people in back rooms and without referring to the people that politicians don't like the popular opinion often. You see it here in the UK. If you went to the UK and said, would you like to bring back hanging? It's always said that most people would say, yes, that may have changed now. But in the end, they don't want to listen to the populist voice. And here he's saying, this is another stitch-up happening here between my rivals. They don't want me to win, and that's because they don't want you to have your say. And in that, he is articulating something that's quite important. And if that air isn't let out of the room, we will see the rise of more populist parties.
Yeah, and we're seeing them across Europe, aren't we? But, I guess he's right, isn't he? At some level, the other candidates for the Republican nomination are backed by big interest groups and big money. And
look,
there's
no
getting away from that, is there?
The last populist party that was successful in the United States was the Republicans in 1860 with Abraham Lincoln. There have been repeatedly populist parties, third parties, and they have never managed to overthrow the two-party system. I think possibly this might be the same thing.
Well, finally today, truth can sometimes be stranger than fiction. The Chinese Communist Party is creating its own mini-series to rival House of Cards. It's about President Xi's crusade against corruption. Matthew, do you think TV shows are good at campaigning, are good at changing how people see their life in their country and their world? Can you use a piece of, ultimately propaganda like this to kind of change people's opinions?
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating question, isn't it? I mean, I wonder whether these programs serve more to open a window for us looking from outside in into the country to see what are the preoccupations of the ruling class and what kind of objectives they're trying to fulfill through making them, rather than whether they make a great deal of change. I remember working in Pakistan, there was a TV show, a very slick series that was produced by the military called Invincible Spirits, Immortal Souls, and it was documenting true stories, in quotes, of valor of the military fighting the Taliban, and also villagers taking up arms to fight the Taliban. And I think there was one episode where the women in a certain besieged village all got together and started shooting out of their houses at the advancing insurgents. So it was very clear messaging that we all need to get on board and fight the Taliban. I don't know how successful it was, but it certainly had some entertaining episodes.
Now, House of Cards, which Kathleen has confessed, I can't believe this, she's never seen a single episode of. The extraordinary thing about...
I haven't either. Oh, God,
you need less busy socialising. You need to stay at home a bit more. I could help you out. Kathleen, the interesting thing about House of Cards is that people who watch it feel that they're getting a bit of an insight into the kind of machinations of what happens at the White House, how you become a politician in the US. And this program hints it might try to do a little bit the same. It's apparently the first time that they'll kind of show proper leading figures in the Communist Party who are now disgraced and show their downfall. Again, when you watch TV or when you watch movies, do you feel any of them are very good ever at kind of cracking open that notion of what it is like to be a politician? Have you ever watched a movie or a TV show you think, this actually brings home to me what it is like to be a politician?
No, actually. I mean, I've found, you remember Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, and if some years ago, which revealed many respects, was based on things that had actually happened. It's just it was done in a funny manner, and so it went down softly.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both very much for being such useless TV watchers. Matthew Green and Kathleen Burke, thank you very much. And that's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Aguas Pacheco and by Faith Barker. And our studio manager was Chris Grimes. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Josh Fennett and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.